So here I wrote a summary of what we've done last week. I will try not to raise it, so if you want, you can take a picture later. You don't need to rush and copy everything. So we started from a few definitions of what we are looking at, so configuration space, tangent space. So configuration space is a snapshot of what the system is at a given instant, how it does look like. Tangent space is the position with the velocity at that given instant, all the how things is changing at that given time. Phase space has this is about not velocities, but momenta, which are a bit more counterintuitive because they're based on this Legendre transform. In simple cases, there is not a huge difference between momenta and velocities, but mathematically and conceptually, they're quite different objects. Then we introduce histories, which is they are functions from time to configuration space or maybe to phase space. So these histories tell us, once we know a history, we know how the system has behaved throughout time, not just how it looks at a given instant. Then we introduce Lagrangian functions and action functionals. So Lagrangian function is a function on phase space, and the action functional takes a Lagrangian and a history and give us a number. Hamilton's action principle then tells us that to every system we can associate a Lagrangian, and that the physically realized histories are those that extremize the action function at fixed boundary condition. So we have that delta S should be zero, and this delta, this variation, should be taken in the space of histories that have the same boundary conditions. Where we put these boundary conditions, well, we saw that these are in Q, but if we really want, that's where they come out naturally, but if we really want, we have some freedom, and this is what we saw in the tutorial. This action principle then led us to deduce the equations of motion, so a history that satisfies this variational equation tells us that, well, must satisfy the Euler-Lagrange equation of motion. These are equivalent to the Newton equations if the Lagrangian has a specific form, which is the kinetic minus the potential. So this is a generalization of what we already knew from Newtonian mechanics. Now then we looked at this equation. We found out that they were second order. We started asking, oh, how we can integrate them, how we can find solutions. And we thought a good idea could have been to write them in as first order equations. And the nice way to do so is to, instead of using the velocities as an independent variable, is rather to use the momenta. So these momenta are defined as the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the velocity. So if the Lagrangian is convex with respect to the velocities, then we can invert this relation is 1-to-1, and then we can always invert it to find velocities given the momentum, momenta given the velocity. Then we can define the Hamiltonian, which is the Legendre transform of the Lagrangian, and vice versa. The Lagrangian is the Legendre transform of the Hamiltonian, which has that form. And then finally, we can recast our Euler-Lagrange equation in the form of the Hamilton's equation of motion, which are nicely symmetric in Q and P. There is that minus sign, which is fundamental. Naively, this tells us that Q dot is equal to V, and this tells us that P dot is equal to minus the derivative of the potential with respect to the position, so it's the force. So even here, it's quite easy to recover Newton's equation in simple cases. We also saw briefly that these equations of motion can be deduced from a first-order action principle, which involves histories in phase space now, which I wrote over there. And similarly to Hamilton's action principle, we find that the on-shell histories are extrema of the action, but now we have just to keep fixed the Qs at the ends and not the Ps. Or vice versa, if we want, like as we saw again in the tutorial. We can flip that condition by adding a total time derivative to that Lagrangian. Then we try to understand how to write these. So if we have, for example, a function on phase space, we ask, oh, what is its time derivative along a history, a physically realized history. We manipulated it with the expression, and we came up with the idea of introducing this object, the Poisson bracket. The Poisson bracket is a map that takes two functions and give us a third function on phase space, which has this particular formula in terms of coordinate and momentum. It satisfies four fundamental properties. It's Q, it's bilinear, satisfies Jacobi, which makes it into a Lie bracket and the space of function on phase space into a Lie algebra. And the fourth property is the Leibniz rule, because it's built out of derivatives. So it satisfies the Leibniz in each end. So these are the four fundamental properties of a Poisson bracket. And most often, you just need to remember these four and not use its explicit form to prove results, unless they are very specific to a choice of coordinates. If they are general results, everything should follow from these four. We also saw that if we want a change of variable over phase space that sends small p's and q to big p and q's, while maintaining this functional form of this expression for the Poisson bracket, then this change of coordinates that then we call canonical it is canonical if and only if, so preserves this form of the Poisson bracket if and only if the bracket of the new q's and p's is a canonical bracket. So is q's and p give 1, and little big q and big p among themselves give 0. So, and this bracket is implicitly understood with respect to the old one, but of course we would get the same result if we computed it with respect to the new one. So that's why I'm not writing anything here, because this formula makes always sense. So introducing this object, Hamilton's equation can be written as z dot equal the bracket of z and h, or for any function of phase space and time, the evolution along a physical history can be written as the partial derivative of f and the bracket of f plus the bracket of f with h. So this is the intrinsic time dependent of the time dependent function f, but this is where the dynamics comes in, of course. We also remarked some analogies with quantum mechanics, the Poisson bracket with the commutator, and this Liouville equation. I don't think I gave it a name. This Liouville equation with the Ehrenfest theorem. Finally, one last thing we saw is the Noether theorem, which tells us that every time we have an infinitesimal symmetry of the Lagrangian, which is a transformation of the histories such that the variation of the first order variation of the Lagrangian with respect to this change in history is a total time derivative. So the fact that it is a total and not a partial is absolutely important. Tells us that there is a conserved quantity, which is this one. And we saw examples like if there is translational symmetry, then these are the conjugate momenta. If we have time translation symmetry, this is the Hamiltonian. So we get pq dot minus l, and this has the interpretation of an energy. And angular momenta fit this theorem, and anything, in fact, any infinitesimal symmetry that you can think of. So today, so this was just to refresh what we did last week before starting. Is there any questions on this story? Okay. So today what we want to do, first I give one result I forgot to give at the end of last lecture, which is Liouville's theorem. Which we will not really use later, but is a very important result, so it's important that you know that it exists. And then we will move on trying to give a converse of this theorem. So once we have a conserved quantity, we find the associated symmetry. So Liouville theorem says the following. One has there exists a volume form on phase space. Which in canonical coordinates reads, I write it like this. There is a volume form on phase space, which in canonical coordinates reads dq1, dp1, dqn, dpn. So this is called the Liouville form sometimes. And now the result is implicit in what I wrote here, which is that no matter how we choose our canonical coordinates, as long as they're related by canonical transformations, it will look the same. So this is the same, if you want, as dq1, dp1, oops, dqn, dpn. So it looks the same in all canonical coordinates. And so it means that the Jacobian of this transformation is 1. Yes?
Precise, it's supposed to be dq1, dp1. I can't resist that.
dq1, dp1. So dqn, dpn. So it's just all the dq's and all the dp's. So is the obvious one. What is non-trivial is the fact that the Jacobian of the transformation is the identity. You can prove it for a two-dimensional system. That's a cute exercise. If you have, which takes 2 lines to prove. If you have the general case, it's a bit of a nightmare in this formulation. It requires some properties of determinants, knowing how to split them, and so on. But it's a nice exercise to do it for n equal 1, because you see that the Jacobian is given by this bracket. So that's a nice question. But now what is really called the Liouville theorem is this result, which is the hard result, together with the observation of the previous time that remark time evolution is a canonical transformation which implies that this volume form is preserved in time. And in particular, these two things together imply that if we follow in phase space the time evolution, so if we follow these points along their time evolution after time t, and we look at where they go. So this is time evolution after time big T. Well, or let's say from T0 to T1. So this is, and here this might get a crazy shape after this time has elapsed. But crucially, the volume of this region is the same as the volume of the evolved region after this time. So I don't want to formalize it too much, but it's just that this idea that time evolution preserve phase space volume. So let me write it here like this. So if you have a probability distribution over phase space, you can evolve it using this equation. That's another way of phrasing it, because the units of volume do not change. So you can just evolve the probability distribution. So this is crucial in statistical physics, where we have probability distribution in phase space, and we look at how they evolve during time, and maybe if the system is chaotic, these things will get completely deformed and reshuffled all over phase space. However, its volume will stay the same. So that's why it's important. So it's a little bit like unitarity in quantum mechanics, in fact. It's the classic version of that statement. Probabilities are preserved in quantum mechanics, and this is the classical version of that. Okay. So this was what I forgot to say last time. So today we go back to Noether theorem and questions about UVL, because I will not go back to it. Yes?
Can you repeat once again why this is a classical analog of probability distribution?
So in quantum mechanics, you have that the total probability, so the norm of the wave function it can change over time, but its integral, like over the Hilbert space, does not. It must give one, right? So this says that probabilities are conserved. Here, this is the analog statement in the sense that if we know that our system is in a at time t zero is a is in a in an area of phase space of volume V, we follow the time evolution after any amount of time. It will still, like, I'm not phrasing it very nicely, but
what I was confused about was That happens when you take time evolution as your chronicle transformation, and you see that the volume is conserved.
Yes. So I think the nicer way to say it is that if I have a probability distribution, I can think of that as my classical analog of my wave function, because it's a probability distribution of finding the system in a certain place. And I can evolve it using that Liouville equation over there. And the reason why this makes sense is because how do I compute probabilities? I integrate my probability density against the volume form. And the fact that the volume form does not change over time guarantees that I can just evolve the density according to that equation. So when I write something like rho over a certain region of phase space of d, so this is some density, and this gives me some probability. Some probability of finding my system in the region V. And I follow the time evolution of this region, like in that picture, this probability will not change in time, if rho evolves according to that. In that sense, it's the analog, because it's like evolving the wave function and the total, like the total probability doesn't change. So this theorem is the case where rho is 1, so it's a flat distribution over the tree. Anything else? Okay, so now the idea is to say, to reverse Noether theorem and find that conserved quantity implies symmetries. Good. So first I have to give you the definition of what is a conserved quantity in this case. So In this case, a conserved quantity is something such that along a physical history does not change. So we want that d over dt q of s over a physical history does not change. But what is this? If q is a function on phase space, well, I should say that this is some function of phase space and time, maybe, into R. So q, p, t, but this is nothing else than dt of q and q of h. Now, it's nice to assume that we do not have time here. We'll just have a function on phase space so that this is not there. So just to simplify our lives, we consider functions that do not depend explicitly on time. So this is what I wrote in red there. Then q is conserved if and only if qh is 0. So we want our quantity q to commute with the Hamiltonian, and if it does, it will be conserved in time. Now, we have that now we define what we mean, what is our candidate symmetry, and then we will show that it will be a symmetry in the sense that we defined in our second lecture, which was this one. So, given q, which is a function on phase space, define delta q z I equal z I q, or, which is the same, delta q q I is q I q. But what is this? This is nothing else than, if we check our defining formula, we get the first term but not the second, because dq over dp, d little q over dp is 0, so we get that this is dq over dpi. And similarly here, we get the minus sign, like that. So this is a definition. Now we want to check that this is a symmetry. Proposition: if q is conserved, then delta q is a symmetry. Then delta q is a symmetry, an infinitesimal symmetry, of the first order action over there, because we are in the first order formalism, in the Hamiltonian formalism, so we need to use the appropriate action. So this is a Lagrangian of q and p, which is sum of pq dot minus h. So let's Let's prove this. So we start by computing the variation of the proof. So how is this defined? This is defined as L of L first order, is the limit for epsilon that goes to 0 of L first at q plus epsilon delta q, p plus epsilon delta p, and t minus L first at q, p, and t divided by epsilon. So once we know delta q, delta p, this is how we compute delta q, delta L, sorry. So this will be the sum of the variation of p times q dot. So we get delta p I q dot I. So let me write things even more explicitly. Plus the variation pi times the variation of q, the time derivative of the variation of q. Minus, now we have to change to vary the Hamiltonian, so we get dh over dqi delta qi minus dh over dpi delta pi. Okay, so now what do? We integrate by parts, and we find, and we also plug in what we know to be delta p and delta q over here. So here, once we integrate by part, we find the same structure, qi, q, pi dot, plus d over dt of pi delta qi. Then what is this? This is minus, let me write it. So this is, I want to write it as sum of dh, d, well, let me write it just once, because these are the same, they're just z's, z, I, q. But this, using the Leibniz rule, is nothing else than dq, dh, right? So this is just a rewriting of this, it just changing notation. But using Leibniz now, we find that this is equal to hq. But this is zero by hypothesis. Because we assume that it was conserved. So now we just have to deal with these guys over here. What do we find? We find that this is sum over I. Well, I could have written it in this other form. dq dp I qi dot plus dq over dqi pi dot. Sorry, there is a minus probably. An overall minus because pq was minus dq d. Oops.
I'm writing all backwards. So qi qi dot pi pi dot.
So these, you see, there is a q here, but the p there. So there is a p here and the q there with the minus. Here the minus is already there. Plus d over dt pi delta qi. We're done. So this is, since dt over dq is conserved, well, is zero, sorry. So here I'm using that q is a function on phase space that does not depend on time. Maybe I should have made this hypothesis more explicit, but it is what it is. So now this is the total time derivative of q. So this is minus d over dt of q. Sorry, let me write it better. So we have d over dt of minus q from these terms plus the sum of pi delta qi. So we see that this is a total time derivative now, which I call RS. So this is the end of the proof, because we proved that the variation of the Lagrangian is a total time derivative, so we're happy. Let's also check that this is compatible with this formula over here. Of course it is, because this also says that q, equating these two terms, q is equal to the sum over pi delta qi minus rs. It's just that we found it backwards, but this is the same formula that we had. So this is the end of the proof. So why I wrote this like this, I call this like that, because we proved that the variation of the Lagrangian is a total time derivative, and usually we call this object whatever it is, dt over RS. And now comparing what this RS is with our formulas, we find that the Qs and the RS are related in this, and the variations are all related in the same way. So we're just found another. We really went backwards in this. We really reversed this theorem. Questions?
Yeah. So that the Poisson bracket with h and q is zero, that holds even off shell, or.
Okay, so. Yes, so this has nothing to, so this statement, what is it? This statement is not, this must be true at every point of phase space. It has nothing to do with histories, this is pointwise in phase space. So to recap briefly, the usual Noether theorem in the Lagrangian formulation says, oh, let's look at things that leave the Lagrangian invariant. And if you find one, then I can tell you that there is a conserved quantity Q, which you compute this way. Well, invariant up to total time derivatives. And then there is a quantity Q that you can compute this way. Now, in the Hamiltonian formulation, it's quite easy to see that you can go, well, relatively easy to see that you can go the other way. You say, if we have a Q that is conserved in time, so a function on phase space that is conserved in time, then it's conserved in time for all physical histories, if and only if it commutes with the Hamiltonian. So let's start from this definition. Q commutes with H, which certainly implies that dt over Q is 0. So this is a good starting point. Maybe I should write it like this over in the hypothesis of the theorem, would be a bit more fair. Then we can cook up a delta Q very simply by taking Poisson brackets, which has which leaves the Lagrangian invariant up to total time derivatives, and the relationship between Q and this variation is the same, is as before. Okay. So this concludes our discussion of Noether, because we did it one way, now the other way. And I want to mention another more abstract point of view about symmetries in phase space. This is a little bit of an aside, but it's still quite important in the understanding of how to work with phase space. So even though it's a bit tangential to the rest of the course, I think it's still good to see this. So. We saw that, so questions again before I move? Okay. So we saw that if we get a quantity Q, which is a function on phase space, so it's a function of our Qs and Ps, we can build a vector at every point Z in phase space. I can build a vector Xi at that point, by taking the bracket of my coordinate with Q. So this gives me, at every point in phase space, a vector like this, xi of Q. And this is minus dq, dq over dp. And this is minus dq over dq. Maybe I should call it Fs. Otherwise, I keep saying dq over dq, and it's very, very unclear. Because it doesn't need to be conserved, so there's no good reason to call it Q. It's just any quantity F, we write it like this. So it means that everywhere in phase space, we will have these little arrows that do what they have to do. And this is called, I can also write it a little bit more abstractly as xf equal f, or maybe minus f dot, because whatever I put inside here, well, we will see it in a second why this makes sense. But so this is called, this assignment of an arrow at every point of phase space is called a vector field. So in this particular case, we call this a Hamiltonian vector field associated to F. So a vector field is a directional derivative, essentially, because if we have a function over here, we can compute its variation along this arrow in the direction that this arrow points. So I can write x of f equal f f,
which is by Leibniz, the sum over I of df d, sorry, xif df over dzi. So this is, if you want, I don't know which of these writings helps you the most.
You can, they're all equivalent. So this is the directional derivative of f along x, which you can think in coordinates as deriving f in the direction z and then contracting with xi. Or in terms of Poisson brackets, this is f, the bracket between the two functions. Now we saw that if f commutes with the Hamiltonian, then it's a conserved quantity, and this object has the interpretation of a symmetry transformation. So if fh equal to 0, this xi f is precisely the flow of the symmetry transformation. That's what I wrote before. So it tells me what is the small variation of Q and P at that point that gives me the symmetry of the Lagrangian. So that's why these Hamiltonian vector fields are so important in the study of phase space, is because they have the interpretation of symmetries. Of course, it depends on which Hamiltonian you choose, but if you have in mind, like abstractly, you want to think of this object as a symmetry, provided they commute with some Hamiltonian at the end of the day. Now, the question is, what happens if I take one symmetry transformation, then I do another one? Or I do the opposite, do transformation 1 and then transformation 2, or transformation 2 and then transformation 1. I can ask whether these two symmetries commute or not. For example, if I have translations, I can translate along x and along y, or along y and along x, nothing changes. However, with rotation, rotating along axes y and z is not the same as rotating along z and y. And this has deep consequences for the algebra of the spin operator, for example. As you know, you get quantization and this discreteness of the spin just out of the fact that these two symmetries do not commute. So it's extremely important to know whether this symmetry commutes or not and which properties they have. So here we want to answer this question. Think angular momentum and spin quantization. So if you need a motivation for this question, I think this is a pretty good one. Now, here, if we have some function on phase space, we can quickly ask what happens if we do transformation f, well, transformation commute two transformations once we write them in terms of vector fields. So we can ask what happens if we have right? So this is transformation. This is like saying delta f, f delta g minus delta f delta g of f. So this is the same thing. I just writing it, instead of with these little delta, squiggly deltas, I use my vector fields, which are more geometrical way of thinking about them. Oops, here I inverted this. Okay, so now I do a little bit of algebra, and I can, using this formula over here, and what do I find? I find that this is the sum over I and j of xi g di xf j minus xf I di xg j f. I don't know if you're familiar with this notation, but this is just a shorthand for this. Otherwise, I have to write many symbols. So just to emphasize which pattern there is this with this? Oops, sorry. I meant dj of f. And this one, I don't have the red. With this one. Okay, so here is the same. And they are flipped. So there is GF and FG. So here, the term where they both derive F, of course, is where both derivatives act on F, they cancel because of the commutativity of the partial derivatives. So in principle, there would be an extra term with both derivatives acting on F, but these, of course, cancels. So this object over here is a vector field itself. So let me put this up and give this definition, and then we go back to where we were. Definition: if X and Y are vector fields, one defines Z equal X Y is a third vector field defined as follows. This is XJ. Well, maybe I write it J here, so I keep the same. XI dy minus So it's the same formula I wrote there, except then calling things xf and xg, I'm calling them x and y for clarity. With these components, and this quantity is called the Lie bracket. So the Lie bracket takes two vector fields and gives us a third one and satisfies 1, 3. So it's skew, of course. It's bilinear. It's also easy to see, because if I multiply a vector field by a number, by 3, these numbers will come out, and z will be multiplied by 3 as well. And it satisfies Jacobi. This can be checked. So this is also a Lie algebra. So this symbol here is a, so this is a 1. Sorry for my writing. This symbol is math frac x. So you know what I'm writing. And it just means the space of vector fields over P. base of vector fields over P. So what we found is that, well, we were led to introduce this notion of Lie bracket between vector fields by looking at the commutator of two symmetries. And now what we want to ask is, here we're not dealing with any two vector fields. We're dealing with two Hamiltonian vector fields. Does the Lie bracket of two Hamiltonian vector fields is a Hamiltonian vector field itself? So is the Lie bracket of two Hamiltonian vector fields a Hamiltonian vector field itself? So is the bracket of two symmetries a symmetry? That's the kind of question we're asking. And the answer is yes. And we now want to prove it. So we write xf, xg over an arbitrary function f. And we have, which is defined as that formula over there, of course. So now it is, I apologize that I'm using the opposite sign than before, but no, not the opposite sign, but I'm switching the role of f and g's. Okay, so this is by definition what I wrote up there. But now what is this? This is xf with the Lie bracket of f and g by definition. Right? Sorry, not the Lie bracket.
The Poisson bracket.
Because that's how we defined xf in the first place. So this is just by minus the opposite. But now again, what is this? This is xf of a function. So this is again a Poisson bracket. So this is fg with f. And same here. What would you do now? Which property haven't we used that yet? We haven't used Jacobi. Jacobi is something that takes, well, I haven't rewritten it, but is the fact that f, g, h, plus the cyclic the two cyclic permutation of this of this quantity is zero. So here we have two of them. We can use, for example, well, we can use this the antisymmetry of the bracket to flip the order, and then use Jacobi. So this becomes. It's not too hard to see that this will be okay. So it's not using Jacobi. We see that we can recast this as f with the Lie bracket of the big F and big G. There is a minus sign. So, but this is nothing else than the derivative of f along the Hamiltonian vector field of this bracket, which is what I wrote here. I can put the minus sign in front of down here. It wouldn't change anything. Which is the same as x of fg. This doesn't change anything. Because the minus sign, I can bring it in, out, it doesn't matter. This is also x of gf. So this is telling me that I can check whether two symmetries commute by checking what happens to their to the Poisson bracket of the associated generators or charges or what we want to call them. So we conclude that two symmetries commute if and only if two symmetries XF, or I should say XF and XG commute if and only if the bracket FG, we would like to say it's zero. It's not quite zero. If it's a constant, is also working, because since there are derivatives involved here, once it's constant, is also given zero inside. So, and this constant plays a role in theory of central extensions and so on. So it does play an important role in physics. It would be too much of a detour to talk about it now, but if you will hear doing CFTs, conformal field theories, and so on, about central extensions of symmetries and so on, is due to this type of fact that here you could find not zero, but something which is constant. So this bracket is, in fact, very powerful. It's not only encodes the dynamics once we pick the right function to plug in, the Hamiltonian, but it also knows a lot about the symmetry of the theory, especially if they commute, if not. So in this way, we see that once we compute the Poisson bracket between two angular momentum generator, and we find that it doesn't commute, and it gives us the third angular momentum generator, because it also must be a symmetry. This is closely related to, well, in fact, is a classical version of what you do when you study angular momentum in the spin in quantum mechanics, and you show that they not commute. So once you want to quantize it, you have this integrability, like this quantization condition that tells you that the spin must be discrete and all of that. So since the Poisson bracket is the analog of the commutator, that's how all these things talk to each other. Maybe one last comment about this. Remark. If F with the Hamiltonian is zero and G with the Hamiltonian is zero, so they are actual symmetries, not just symmetries in case they commute with the Hamiltonian. Let's assume there is an Hamiltonian for which these are actual symmetries. Then FGH is also a symmetry. So this is actually, commute. Here I should have said commute. Erasing, I forgot a piece. So the bracket of two symmetries is also a symmetry. And this is a small exercise, very small one, that you can do using Jacobi. So it's just, again, one line using Jacobi and permuting these, and you find that the other two vanish by hypothesis. Good. So this concludes this discussion of symmetries in phase space. Maybe the very last remark for the mathematically inclined is that we have two Lie algebras here in play. One is the Lie algebra of vector fields, equipped with this bracket, the square bracket. And here we have a Lie algebra of functions on phase space with the Poisson bracket as a Lie bracket. The fact that these two are related like this, it means that we have an anti-homomorphism, anti just because there is a minus involved, or a flipping of the order. But in any case, the two are homomorphic Lie algebras. And so it's just how a mathematician would call this equality. I'm not adding any content, it's more about language for those who are familiar. Good. Any questions? Otherwise, I'll change topic quite drastically. So,
is it fair to say that commutator in quantum mechanics is a special kind of Lie bracket?
It is a Lie bracket for sure because it satisfies property 1, 2, and 3. The commutator of matrices is one of the many examples of a Lie bracket.
Okay.
Is Q is bilinear easily, and Jacobi follows from the associativity of the multiplication of matrices. So doing A B C is the same as doing A B C, and so it's easy. It's super easy to check that.
So if the Poisson bracket becomes the commutator in QM, what do the Hamiltonian vector fields become?
Good. So the analog there would be a unitary on your Hilbert space that is the symmetry transformation on. So phase space become your Hilbert space. And points in phase space become states upon quantization. So now a small variation or a big variation, like a variation of point in. Okay, let me write it. This is a good question. With big, of course, there's no guaranteed recipe that this will work. But as a as an idea, we get this correspondence. This is phase space, and here we get Hilbert space. A point in phase space should be a state in your Hilbert space. Now, we saw that the Poisson bracket of f and g, so or better, a function on phase space. You can think of these as some operator. So you see that it's not really obvious that these are one to one, but so it's just a mental map to translate. And the idea is that the function evaluated at the point is the expectation value, right? Under this analogy. So half of z becomes, and under this idea, the Liouville becomes Ehrenfest, for example. Then what do we have? We have that the Poisson bracket becomes of f and g becomes the commutator of f and g. Sorry. This is not really true. There can be, it's true for Q as in P's, but if we have larger functions, there could be terms of higher order in H bar. But that's the leading order. So maybe I don't write it, I just write it like this. This is the commutator. Now we asked, what is, so in fact, here we would like this to be also Hermitian. So if this is real, then that should be Hermitian. And then we have that XF is equal to F. So what is this for an Hermitian one? Well, this is, you can think of this as an infinitesimal unitary. So you know a unitary transformation. So if you write u equal e to the I I never know where to put the H bars. Sorry, I don't want to be confused, so I don't put it. But if you have U is equal to, let's say, epsilon F, if F is Hermitian, then U is unitary. And if I do U dagger G U at leading order in epsilon, this will be the Lie bracket, sorry, the commutator of G with F. Now I might get the sign. No, I think the sign is right. So let's say
maybe minus, okay, let's do it like this. E epsilon F over H bar. So we get that U dagger G U is equal to 1 over I H bar
GF, I think. Plus, so there is an epsilon here, plus higher order in epsilon. So this is what your infinitesimal vector field is supposed to be, is an infinitesimal unitary transformation. So it's a symmetry in the sense of quantum mechanics.
And so, like, finding the integral curves of the Hasse-Hutterian vector fields is like constructing the U's, kind of.
Yeah, it's like exponentiating these objects, which is not always easy. You, as you know, there can be path order exponentials and things like this. Exactly. If they, exponentiating a matrix is not the, it can be done, but it's not the, just the exponential of the matrix elements. So it requires a more complicated form, which corresponds exactly to integrating these vector fields in the classical. No, thanks. This was a good point.
Let's see what I can erase.
Now we get to the last chapter of the review of Hamiltonian Lagrangian mechanics. If you want analytical mechanics, sometimes it's called, which is the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. I will not give the full theory behind the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. It's hiding in one of the exercises you will have to do a bit more of it. But I want still you to see this equation appearing in, because again, it has an important analogy in quantum mechanics, and it's also quite used when one does, for example, holography. So it's good that you know where it's coming from in classical physics. So let's start with the setup. So what we, by looking at what we have there in the first two columns, we have a Lagrangian and an action, and we use this to deduce what are the on-shell histories. But we never checked what it means to evaluate our action on an on-shell history. Like, once we have this physical history, what is this function giving us? We used it, but we never went back to ask what it was good for. So set up. Or physical, if you want. So
So now I define the function curly s, which is a function on let me write it, and then I will say so.
I wrote this curly s, which is a function of four real numbers, q0, q1, t0, and t1. So what am I doing? I'm taking my action and evaluating it on a non-shell history, but not any history. It's the one determined by these boundary conditions. So I know I say that this is not unique and could also not exist, but let's suppose that we have this. Usually we have this in some small open neighborhoods and stuff like this. But let's suppose we have it, and just because what we are more interested in is to pick one history, then we pick its boundary conditions and so on, and then we vary it. So we look to neighboring history, and so in that case, it's not a problem. We don't need this to be well-defined for all q0 and q1, etc. We just pick some value for which it is well defined, and we make small variations of them. So we are kind of safe on that front. So is it clear how this is defined? This is called Hamilton's principal function. It's not a phrase that is I hear very often, but just to give names, Hamilton's principal. So often it's just called S, not curly S. But here I want just to emphasize that is slightly, it's a different function than the action because it depends on different quantities, but of course it is related. The action was a function on history space. This is a function of the boundary conditions. So it's slightly different. So if we want to study this quantity, this Hamilton's principal function, then the best we can do, in a way, is to study what happens if we change its arguments a little bit. So we want to look at the derivatives in t and in q. So we say that d over dq1 of curly s, what this is, S so here, if we vary Q1, for example, what are we doing? We're taking two different histories determined by slightly different boundary conditions and comparing the action on these two. So let me actually, how I want to, sorry, and let me check which notation I've used. So I haven't used this one. So let's say this is epsilon delta xi q bar minus where q bar plus epsilon delta psi q bar is the solution to the Euler-Lagrange equations defined by so let me call it Q prime. Q bar prime by bar prime is equal to q bar zero. At t0 is equal to q0 plus, which is was the initial condition for q bar, the one we started from, plus epsilon delta xi q bar at t0, and similarly for t1. So what does it mean? It means that, in particular, this means that, I should be more careful. So q bar t1, on the other hand, is unchanged, right? Because we're only modifying, oh, I should have done the opposite. Great. So 1, 1, 1, and I'm modifying, sorry, my bad. So we're modifying the arrival point, but not the initial point, the starting point. So this means that delta q bar 1 is xi. And sorry, how am I writing? And I call this, sorry, my bad. I wanted to, and delta q bar 0. So xi is the variation of the final condition, and delta xi is the variation of the history defined by that that variation of the boundary condition. Sorry, it's a little bit, I got mixed up with my notes. So recapitulating, we are changing the boundary conditions, and I'm changing them by a little amount xi only for the arrival one, the final one. This means that the whole history then is changed by a certain quantity, delta xi of q. So the drawing will be, I have time, I have q, I have a history that starts here and ends here. So t1, t0, I have q0 bar, q bar 1. And what I'm doing, I'm looking at the new history that starts in the same spot, but ends slightly over here. Of course, to be able to do this, I need to change the initial velocity, for example. It's not that they start exactly the same. Otherwise, this wouldn't work. Okay, so now we go back to the action and compute what this variation is. So it seems a bit desperate, but of course we know that we have the Euler-Lagrange equation in the bulk, so the only variations that matters is the one at the boundary. So that's why we are able to do this computation. So we compute now S over here. So this we right, this is just delta xi of s. So d over dq1 of my curly s is equal to, this is not just this is this multi. Okay, this is getting a more involved than I wished for. Okay, now it makes more sense. Because here I'm using psi, so I'm changing q1 in the direction psi. So sorry about that. This is. So this is this delta psi of the action. But since it's a variation of the action, this is dt over dxi of L. Since I'm not touching t's, I'm just touching the history q. So at this point, this becomes, with the usual procedure, which I'm not repeating, I get the Euler-Lagrange
term here times delta xi q plus a boundary term, which is, as usual, the sum of p pi delta xi qi at t1 and t0.
So these will be zero because by hypothesis we're evaluating these things on shell histories. So both q and q prime are on shell, so that term for sure will be zero. And here what we find, in fact, q bar is enough. Q bar is on shell. So by construction, by definition, so this will drop, and we are left with this. But this is what? Delta psi q by hypothesis was zero at the starting point and something at the arrival point. So we get that this is the sum of pi at t1 times xi I. So now comparing the left-hand side and the right-hand side, we find that the partial derivative of the Hamilton's principal function by the arrival boundary condition is the arrival momentum. Which momentum? The momentum is p I at t1 for that on-shell history associated to those boundary conditions. So one always has I should put bars. Yes. Okay. So if you want, how much this changes depends on how much the final velocity was in the first place. So since next time we will do the second time, the derivative with respect to time. We didn't do it with respect to q naught. What do we expect? We don't expect a big change, but there is a small change. The small change is the sign of this, because this will appear with a minus, of course. So we get d curly s over dq 0. Q1i over here. And here we call it dq 0i will be minus p at t0. So we did, the computation is exactly the same, so I'm not going to redo it. Next time we will do the t's, and the t's will be much more involved because they appear also not just in L, but also in the computation. But so we will leave that for tomorrow. No, Wednesday, whenever.
To vary the boundary conditions, because we have already solved the problem using the Anshu principle and we found those boundary conditions and they were fixed. So we are now varying them. What does it mean?
No. So okay, I understand the question. The action principle says I fix the boundary condition and I find one physical histories. So for each choice of boundary conditions, there is a physical history, hopefully. It's not fully true, but let's say if it works, that's what it says. Now, but I can choose the boundary conditions to be they could be different, and this would give a different physical history.
Satisfy the action principle that we already had.
No. When I say at fixed boundary conditions, I don't mean that Q. Let's draw this. So here, we have T0, Q0, and Q1, T1. And we're looking for, we know that delta S at gamma bar will be 0, is the physical history. So let me write it in red, draw it in red. So, and this is our physical history. Now, this is the one among all of those that satisfy this boundary condition, which minimizes the action. Okay. But you see, I'm taking all these white ones and I'm picking the red one once after choosing Q0 and Q1 and T0 and T1. So the algorithm is the following. Choose Q0, Q1, T0, T1, and out and find the gamma bar of T0, Q0, T1, T1, such that S is minimal. I put it in quote because it's not super clear. Now, what happens if I choose slightly different starting and ending point? So now the game is about moving this point around a little bit. Up and down means changing Qs. Left and right means changing Ts. And this is the game you are playing now. But on the red ones. Now we have now we know which one we want to evaluate the action on, and so the only things that the Hamilton's principal function depend on is this T0 Q0 and T1 Q1, and now I play the game of changing them. Is that clear? Yeah, okay. So next step is curly S Q0 T0 etc. is S of the on this one. And now we play the game of varying Q0, Q1, and T0, T1.
Analogy with QM. So I know that like by exponentiating we can only obtain like a connected component of symmetric group or whatever. So here like is there some analog of like disconnected components for these vector fields when I try to like integrate them?
Can you repeat the first part?
So by exponentiating some generator, I only get the sort of connected part of the group, like to the identity.
Ah, so here if you start from a group, so here we're not really going to do that much, but one can start from the group and build a unitary implementing those group transformations. But the algebra, once you exponentiate, you only get the connected component to the identity. So the vector fields, the Hamiltonian vector fields, only know about this connected component, because how do you get the other? Usually with Lorentz group, for example, you have the proper orthochronous Lorentz group, which is the connecting component to the identity. And to get all the rest, you need to do parity and time reversal symmetries, which are discrete. So there you have to do some jumps. You can't quite do things smoothly and connect two points. So these vector fields know only about the part connected to the identity. You can still do a discrete symmetry over phase space. You map Q in to minus Q, but this will not be implementable through a vector field. So one are, they're still diffeomorphisms, but they do not have an infinitesimal analog. So that group, this group is mapped into a subgroup of the diffeomorphisms group, but only the infinitesimal, the part connect, I think you got the idea, but I can try to, we can try to discuss it. I want to erase the blackboards for Bindiya and give you a break. So, but if you want, we can go back. This one?
I wonder, yeah, if the analog is between like canonical transformations on one side and then unitaries on the other.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would. I think so. I would say. Yes?
Just to check if I understand correctly, then is it fair to say that by varying the behavior in the middle and fixing the boundary conditions, we can find the physical history, mm-hmm. and then by varying boundary conditions, we can find boundary behaviors of that physical history, is that right?
Yeah, this is more or less what is happening. So by varying these, it tells you more information about their physical history. So it tells you what is the momentum, which is the information you didn't know before.
Okay.
Right? At that point. So it gives you the other piece. So you can find, you're probing this physical history at this end, in some sense. It's not obvious at the beginning, because it might depend on what has happened everywhere, but somehow is implicit in the fact that there is only one history that you've chosen, and it gives you exactly the momentum at the end. So yeah, I would say that that's what you said is correct.
Thank you.
I will mention it next time a bit better, but this is, if you have seen a path integral, this is like doing the saddle point approximation of the path integral, and this is like changing the boundary conditions to the path integral. That's exactly what the classical analog of that. But I will go back to it next time.